15 things you didn't know about.
Back to school, bitches.
Welcome to alux.com, the place where future billionaires come to get inspired. Subscribe to alux.com. Hello, Aluxers. Today we're talking about one of the biggest names in the world and America's greatest inventor. He was an exquisite businessman, a CEO, an inventor, and a man that left as legacy the light bulb, sound recording, and motion picture. His name is Thomas Edison. If this name doesn't ring a bell for you, then maybe we should give you some backstory. Some people say he was influential, some say he was a fraud, but all in all, most people credit him for being one of the pioneers of the modern industrialized world. He was born in the Midwestern United States, and through his lifetime, he managed to get his name on some of the most important parks, buildings, streets, and institutions throughout America. Thomas Edison was a man larger than life that is still honored up to this day. He had a long life filled with success, awards, and good friends. So, let's have a look at his life, his secrets, his fortune, and the legacy he left us. Number 1. He was homeschooled and self-taught. Nowadays, rich people and successful businessmen are all graduates of Ivy League schools and great MBA programs. More than 100 years ago, school was not the only institution that would grant a successful career. Thomas Edison, for example, was homeschooled and self-taught. Because of that, he was able to pursue his passions, read multiple books, and get small side jobs to raise money for his projects. He got his first job at 12 years old. All his knowledge came from his curiosity and working multiple jobs. Edison was a self-driven man who loved competition and business, showing that a brilliant mind doesn't necessarily need a formal education. Number 2. He was deaf from an early age. It seems that geniuses and great minds always have some sort of medical problem that's actually helping them perform better. Thomas Edison was deaf. He developed ear problems from an early age, yet nobody ever knew why. Multiple stories circulated around, but none were confirmed. However, Edison never saw the issue as a handicap or a setback. For him, it was just a veil of silence, meaning more concentration and less disturbance. Although he couldn't cure his deafness, he helped the world to see better and brought light into our lives. Number 3. He held over 1,093 patents in the U.S. alone. Edison had a specific way of doing his work. He would spend a lot of time doing the experiments and improving it, rather than having a vision and sketching it perfectly from the start. As an inventor, he held over 1,093 patents in the U.S. alone, and many more in other countries. He's credited for many modern things we use today, like x-rays, electric lamps, and telephones. What good is it to have a patent? Every time someone wants to use your design or product, they need to pay you. If the patent is granted to you, then it becomes your property. Even so, patents have a shorter lifespan than a copyright. Number 4. He made up fake news as a joke. Back in the day, Thomas Edison had the chance to talk to Bertie Charles Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine. It was an American magazine that at the time needed a juicy story from Edison. He didn't want to disappoint, so he made one up. He told him he was currently working on a spirit phone to allow communication with the dead. The story was quickly picked up by other publications, even though Edison dismissed it later on. This could be considered early fake news, but Edison was also known for twisting stories and telling multiple versions. Number 5. His net worth was around $170 million. With so many patents and a profitable company under his name, Thomas Edison was a well-known businessman that managed to mix work with success. Unlike other inventors, he knew how to invest and make money, and he made millions of it. At the time of his death, he had gathered $12 million, which translates into $170 million after inflation adjustments. His leadership style was admired by many people, Because at that time, many people were trying to invent the next big thing and revolutionize the world. As you've seen many times on our channels, running a mega business while also juggling projects and a personal life is not an easy job. Number 6. He tortured animals just to prove a point. Edison wasn't the only one playing with electricity and breakthrough inventions. He was working with direct current, while George Westinghouse worked with alternating current. Because Edison had more support and the invention of the light bulb in his hand, he used them to bring down high-voltage alternating current. To show people just how dangerous and useless alternating current is, he used to electrocute stray dogs and cattle to prove his point and destroy his competition. Although he tried his best, nowadays we use alternating current, showing that Edison, in fact, was wrong. He even supported the electric chair execution because it was done with high-voltage alternating current. Number 7. He pirated hundreds of copies of A Trip to the Moon. Copyright and piracy have been a massive problem for artists and filmmakers. A lot of money and effort goes into a production and marketing, so it's only natural to support and honor that. The first movies were made a little over 100 years ago, and Edison was one of the pioneers in this industry. He made various films, but he also broke copyright. He made hundreds of copies of Georges Méliès' movie A Trip to the Moon, to the point of bankrupting him. The only benefit of this action was the fact that the movie was very well received and loved by Americans, although Méliès made no money out of it. This was all happening back in 1902. Number 8. His relationship with Nikola Tesla is overly exaggerated. Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison are both great inventors, partners, and rivals. They were working in the same field and were fighting for the same piece of the pie. Although they weren't best friends or managing partners, history twisted their rivalry into drama and exaggerations. Tesla worked for Edison's company for a while, but then they parted ways because they wanted to work on different ideas. They had some differences and a rivalry, but nothing like bullying, fights, and bad blood. Their relationship has actually been misunderstood for decades. Number 9. He had a very strange hiring strategy. Getting a job has always been difficult. Back in Edison's time, smart and qualified people were in need just like they are today, but they also needed to test them before hiring. Because Edison was such a good businessman, he was in charge of this process too. The strangest thing he did was to ask candidates to eat a bowl of soup as a part of the test. All he wanted to know by this was if they added salt and pepper before tasting it. Why is that relevant? Because he wanted people who didn't make assumptions. Smart, right? Number 10. He owned multiple big estates. Thomas Edison knew how to make money and also where to invest them. He bought a few houses for his comfort, and they were as you would expect, big, comfortable, and fitted for a millionaire. Most of his past homes are now museums or tribute estates. He had a holiday house in Fort Myer, Florida, and one in New York City. They're all still standing, showing the lavish lifestyle Americans had 100 years ago. Edison raised his 6 children there and left them many other properties that honored his name. The Menlo Park house his son built sold for $6 million. And A-Luxers, want to know how much money other CEOs make? Head over to our video where we rank the highest paid CEOs in the world. Just click in the top right corner to check it out. Number 11. He was backed by J.P. Morgan and the Vanderbilt family. Although Edison managed to make money from his patents and his company, he still needed funding for some of his projects. He was lucky enough to live in a time when J.P. Morgan and the Vanderbilt family were open toward supporting inventions and investing. He was also friends with Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone. They helped each other and spent holidays together. Edison had good communication skills that helped him promote his ideas and get funding if needed, even though he had some failed projects too. Number 12. The company he founded is now worth $244 billion. The legacy Edison left for the world is obvious, but for his fellow Americans, he left them an even bigger heritage. General Electric, one of the biggest companies in the world, that's now worth over $244 billion. General Electric was one of the first companies that formed Dow Jones Index and is still among the companies that can show just how well the American economy performs. Although it was partially founded by Edison, it now has two employees awarded with Nobel Prizes and revenues of over $122 billion. Number 13. He proposed to his wife using Morse code. Proposals are always romantic. Whether you like them or not, they're one of the cheesiest and most tear-dropping moments for a couple. There are millions of ideas on how to propose, and each couple has a certain way of showing affection. Edison wasn't the most romantic person, but he did like to communicate in a more creative way. Since he was responsible for one of the first wireless transmissions, he used Morse code even when talking to his wife. In fact, he actually proposed with Morse code. This might have also been partially because he was almost entirely deaf. Number 14. His last breath was recorded for Henry Ford. Edison's legacy will always live on in the world because he's done so much toward modernization and comfort. Even his friends acknowledged his importance. It's said that Thomas Edison's last breath was recorded and stored in an airtight tube. This was done at Henry Ford's request by Edison's son. It now lies in the Thomas Edison Museum. The tube itself went through some crazy hands and owners, and some even claim that it's all bonkers. There are apparently 42 tubes with Edison's last breath, so it must have been quite a long one. Number 15. Footballer Pelé is named after Thomas Edison. We all like to believe that our name carries great tradition and significance. Some of us get warrior names, some those of a god, and so on. The famous Brazilian football player Pelé got his name after Thomas Edison. Pelé was born Edson Arantes do Nascimento, but on many documents he's referred to as Edison. His father wanted to name him Edson, similar to Edison, as a tribute to the man who invented the light bulb. Unfortunately, though, everyone calls him Pelé, so the reference got lost along the way. The lives of the rich and famous are always filled with crazy extravaganza and some drama. The great inventors of the last century really have outdone themselves, and it's amazing to see that in 100 years, so many things have changed, yet it seems like a lot of them are still the same. We now have electricity, smartphones, and spaceships, yet we still hire people the same way and have the same shopping habits. What do you guys think Edison was best at? Getting help from smart people around him or innovating? Let us know in the comments section. And of course, for sticking with us until the end, we have another fact in honor of Edison and his great achievements. This one's for Adele, phoning from the other side. Number 16. He said the first hello over the phone. Have you ever wondered why we say hello when we answer the phone? Who said it first and why we still use it today? Well, Thomas Edison didn't quite invent the phone, but he helped with its development. Edison was the man that urged people using his phone to say hello when answering. Alexander Graham Bell wanted ahoy to be used instead, but it didn't stick. Which makes us curious. What do you say when answering the phone? Thank you for spending some time with us, A-Luxers. Make sure to like and subscribe so you never miss another video. We also handpicked these videos, which we recommend you watch next. You can talk to us on all social medias or ask a question on our website, alux.com. Thank you for being an A-Luxer, and we'll see you back tomorrow.
His is one of the great American sagas. Some say the greatest. It started humbly on the night of February 11, 1847, in a small red brick house in Milan, Ohio, the home of the man who ran the town shingle factory. On that February night, he sat in the parlor of his home. In the bedroom, his wife lay awaiting the birth of her seventh child. Death had claimed earlier children. So that the father's prayers fill the anxious hours until the father inscribed the name of a healthy, husky boy in the family Bible. Humble beginnings, but not poor. The Edison children were reared on good food and the good book. They were all good, hard, common sense kids, said the neighbors. Except for young Tom. They called him the curious boy, meaning he had too much curiosity about things. When he was five, they found him sitting on some duck eggs to see if he could hatch them. It was possibly his first experiment. It was not successful. When the family moved to Port Huron, Michigan, the curious boy started school. He exasperated his teacher. The boy is backward, the teacher complained. All he does is ask questions. Nonsense, said the boy's mother. I'll teach him myself. And she did. Her method was reading, writing, and arithmetic. And then she simply encouraged him to read, read, read. The more he read, the more his curiosity grew. By the time he was 12, he wanted to know what the whole wide world was about. So he decided to go into business. 1859, the great railroads were beginning to crisscross America. Any 12-year-old boy would naturally go down to the railroad station to seek his fortune. Tom Edison talked the Grand Trunk Railway into giving him the job of selling candy and newspapers on the daily run from Port Huron to Detroit. He also talked the conductor into giving him a corner of the baggage car. In this corner, he set up a chemical laboratory. His curiosity didn't stop at chemistry. He got interested in printing when he was 14. So he set up his own printing press and started the first newspaper ever published on a railroad train, anytime, anywhere. The Weekly Herald, published by A for Al, as he was called, Edison, was only a single sheet affair, but he crammed it with general information and gossip. Local and international news. Business facts and figures. Vital statistics. Philosophy. Reason, justice, and equity never had weight enough on the face of the earth to govern the councils of men. But at the height of his success as chemist, candy butcher, publisher, philosopher, two accidents occurred. First, he became partially deaf.
Deafness drove me to reading. My refuge was the Detroit Public Library. I didn't read a few books. I read the library.
And he learned how to operate a telegraph ticker. The second accident occurred when one day his chemical jars broke open and set fire to the baggage car. The conductor put him off the train together with all his chemicals and his curiosity. He was 16 years old now, an unemployed candy butcher and newspaper publisher. But he'd also learned how to send and receive messages over the telegraph ticker. In 1864, he became a wandering telegraph operator. The fastest operator that ever came down the pike, also the most restless. Couldn't stay in one place for long. For 4 years, he ticked his way across the country, a kind of long-haired hobo, always tinkering with wires and things, but gathering no moss, making no money.
No matter what I may do, I reap nothing but trouble and the blues. It is all I can do to keep the wolf from the door.
But he was working harder than he was worrying, and he invented the universal stock ticker, his first major invention. Western Union paid him $40,000 for it. He took the money and invested in a dream. All during the hobo years, he had dreamed of building a laboratory. And finally, in 1876, he settled in the little town of Menlo Park, New Jersey. To his home there, he took his young bride, Mary Stillwell Edison. Close by the house, the main laboratory building was connected to the outside world by telegraph wires. The chemistry lab was the little candy butcher's dream come true. He filled his lab with the best technicians and the best machines money could buy. He was the first man to conceive of an invention factory, a hive of specialists on a belt line. At the top of the line was the old man, as they called him even then, supplying the ideas and the inspiration. He announced to the world,
I'll produce a minor invention every month, and a major one every 6 months.
It was no idle boast, and the invention started pouring out of Menlo Park. To his deftness, he attributed one of his early contributions.
When Bell first worked out his telephone idea, I tried it, and the sound which came through the instrument was so weak, I couldn't hear it. I started to develop it and kept on until the sounds were audible to me. My improvement, the carbon transmitter, made the telephone possible.
The repeating telegraph was a machine which automatically took down telegraph messages for relay at high speed. It consisted of a piece of thick paper which spun around a blunt needle, which made dot and dash indentations on the paper. One day, Edison was tinkering with the machine. The paper disc started spinning too rapidly, and through his deafness, he heard a strange sound.
If I could record the action of the point, and then send the point over the same surface again, I saw no reason why the thing...
Crucy, his chief machinist, made the model for a total cost of $18. A group of assistants gathered around the old man's desk. None of them knew what the fantastic-looking thing was supposed to do. They stood silently while Edison took a piece of tinfoil, inserted a mouthpiece on the contraption, and then, to everyone's astonishment, started reciting these momentous words.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. I made a bet of 15 cigars that the machine would talk back to me. Mary had a little lamb. His face was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
He won the bet. What should he call it? Telephone? Telegraph? He named it the phonograph. It became the sensation of the day and age. The 31-year-old inventor was invited to the White House to demonstrate his machine for President Hayes. Never in the whole history of science and invention had there been anything like this, a machine that talked, and the world clamored to listen to it. In restaurants and saloons and penny arcades, the first jukeboxes were installed, and while the words and music poured into every ear, the name of Edison was on every tongue. A philosopher of the time said it was the era of the nickel in the slot machine.
Every Saturday, Willie got his pay. Then he called for Nell.
In It was always Mr. Edison's own favorite invention. He was always bubbling over with new ideas for it, new applications.
On Nellie's little hat, there was...
He had hoped the little box would be a great educational device, recording the Washingtons and Lincolns for posterity. But what the public wanted from it was entertainment. And the great names of the entertainment world hastened to oblige. Rachmaninoff. Matzenauer. Albert Spaulding. And even Sybil Sanderson Fagan, the whistling artist. And as the years went by, they trooped in and out of Edison's recording rooms. The opera singers and the banjo players and the bird imitators and the tellers of jokes. And the records poured forth, hundreds of them, thousands, hundreds of thousands. From the needle that scratched the tinfoil, a $1 million industry was born. Shortly after the world had seen the wizardry of the invention of the phonograph, the Wizard of Menlo Park started a fresh notebook. It was the first of many on a new subject.
The object of this invention is to devise an electric lamp, which shall admit of being worked in great numbers on one electrical circuit.
The invention of the phonograph had been all Edison, but when he turned his luminous curiosity on the problem of making an electric light, he was moving into a field where many others were working. The first thing Edison did was to learn everything he could about the subject. He came to the crux of the problem. 1. If you heat certain materials by electricity, they give off light. 2. If you heat these materials in a vacuum, they last much longer. So he told his glass blowers in the invention factory to make him some glass bulbs. This would be his vacuum, in which he would heat something by electricity. Heat what? What would glow with a light that was continuous and bright and easy on the eye? Now the laboratory became his home. Day, night, time itself meant nothing to him. He tried everything in the search for the proper thing to heat in the vacuum. After trying metals, he started on the world of organic matter. Anything, everything within reach. Human hair, wood, leather, macaroni.
Now we know another thing that won't work. That's progress.
Finally, one day he took a piece of common cotton thread and placed it in a crucible and baked it in a furnace. Out of the furnace came a thin thread of pure carbon. He attached this filament to electric wires inside the bulb. He pumped the air out of the bulb. He turned on the electric current. This was the light he wanted, but how long would it last? Edison and his assistants gathered around for the famous death watch of October 19, 1879. They watched the lamp for 10 hours.
Give it more juice.
20 hours.
More juice.
30. For 2 days and two nights, the lamp burned.
Now I knew we had it.
He invited the world. A world still lit by candles and gaslight, to come to Menlo Park to see. They came. On New Year's Eve, 1879, they came by the trainload and they saw. New light to the new world on this New Year's Eve, cried the press. The newspapers called it the miracle of the 19th century. Lighting up Menlo Park was only a stunt for New Year's Eve. The real test came when Edison announced that he would illuminate 1 square mile of the heart of New York City with a newfangled electric light. The bulb, the miracle bulb that gave the miraculous light, was only the beginning, the end component of 1,000 component parts. You need rheostats and generators and meters and fuses and sockets and switches and conductors to make it work. The incandescent light was not one, but 360 different inventions all welded together. To lay his lines and cables, he had to dig down into the bowels of the city. Edison himself supervised every move day and night. In later years, he was to say,
"This was the greatest adventure of my life."
To make light, you need power. He took a building on Pearl Street in Lower Manhattan and turned it into the first power plant for electric light in the United States. It started with coal furnaces in the basement. The coal made steam. The steam made power. The power turned the generators. From the generators came electricity. And the electricity became light. Light to the world. But hardly 2 years after the great triumph, tragedy struck the house of Edison. He tried to lose himself in work, but to the great giver of light, Menlo Park was full of shadows now. He had to move away, away from the place where he had lived for 8 happy years. 2 years after Mary Edison died, he found a haven in West Orange, New Jersey, in the lordly house called Glenmount. In the year 1886, he was 39 years old when he married Nina Miller, herself the daughter of an inventor.
My later courtship was carried on by telegraph. I taught the lady of my heart Morse code, and we got along much better than we could have with spoken words by tapping our remarks to one another on our hands. Presently, I asked her thus if she would marry me. The word yes is an easy one to send by telegraphic signals, and she sent it.
And here he took his new bride to live. Beyond the fields of Glenmount, just down the road, he built his new laboratory. Brick this time. The finest invention factory in the world. The big brother of Menlo Park. The nerve center of the compound was the old man's roll-top desk in an office that was 2 stories high, crammed with 10,000 scientific volumes. It was his combination office, laboratory, studio, library, and bedroom. On a small cot, he took his famous cat naps.
I never found need of more than 4 or 5 hours sleep in the 24. People talk of loss of sleep as a calamity. They better call it loss of time, vitality, opportunity.
No matter how hard he worked, he could always find time for his children. When they were away, he wrote them playful letters to be read in a mirror. On one of their toys, the wheel of light now caught his fancy.
It occurred to me that it was possible to devise an instrument that should do for the eye what the phonograph did for the ear.
His first idea was to put a continuous line of tiny photographs on a cylindrical shell, just like a photograph record, then to rotate the shell and let the eyes look at the photographs through a magnifying glass. It didn't work well enough to suit Edison. Then he thought, if he could put a long line of photographs on some sort of strip or tape, on something you could roll up. One day, he saw an advertisement for a new kind of camera designed by a man named George Eastman. It took pictures on celluloid.
Without George Eastman, I don't know what the result would have been in the history of the motion picture. He tried to develop a narrow strip of sensitized film that would operate on a roll.
Observe, says the legend, that each picture has a slight change of position as it passes the point of vision. The rapid photograph of these different stages of movement upon a long strip of light-sensitive film creates the illusionary spectacle of movable figures. In order to see the figures move, you look through the magnifying glass of a peephole machine.
Our studio was almost as amazing as the pictures we made in it. It was such an ungainly looking structure when it was done, and the boys had so much sport with it that we called it the Black Moriah. In order to make certain of as long a working day as possible, we swung the whole building on pivots, like an old-fashioned river bridge, so it could be turned to follow the course of the sun. It was a ghastly proposition for a stranger daring enough to brave its mysteries. But we managed to make pictures there, and after all, that was the real test.
They made pictures there. Fred Ott Sneeze, the first copyrighted film. May Irwin and John Rice, the first movie kiss. The story of an American fireman, the first story film.
Did you know that one of my first thoughts for the motion picture was to combine it with the phonograph? My plan was to synchronize the camera and phonograph so as to record sounds when the pictures were made and reproduce the two in harmony. Talking pictures.
Projector in his office, he showed the first home movies. The camera followed on one of his camping trips with his good friends Henry Ford, Harvey Firestone, and the naturalist John Burroughs. But in the right years of his life, he found it good sometimes to rest from the hard job of being a wizard. At his winter home in Fort Myers, Florida, his family and friends would gather round.
What do I think of Einstein's theory? I don't think anything of it, because I don't understand it.
And he liked to drive around the grounds of Fort Myers in a car given him by an old and grateful friend, Henry Ford, whose early experiments with a combustion engine Edison had encouraged. And he liked to sit and look at nature.
Good day for an angel's picnic. They could lunch on the smell of flowers and new mown hay, drink the moisture of the air, and dance to the hum of the bees.
But even in Fort Myers, he couldn't sit still for very long. Close by his home, he built a small laboratory. His friends Ford and Firestone had presented him with a great challenge. Could he find a domestic source of natural rubber? The best source, he reasoned, would be something that grows in great abundance. What was more abundant than the flowers of the field around him? He started by testing every plant, every flower, every leaf, every growing thing he could lay his hands on. Thousands of them tested and carefully classified in his notebooks on his neat shelves. Finally, he settled on the goldenrod as the most practicable source of rubber. Why? Because it was so plentiful. He worked late into the night on the incredible notion of squeezing rubber out of goldenrod, though the famous catnaps were growing longer. He didn't give up until, out of the lowly goldenrod, he actually produced his last legacy to humanity. His desk at the West Orange Laboratory is, as he left it, crammed full of innumerable projects, improvements on the old inventions, plans for many, many new inventions, telephone, telegraph, dynamo. He had taken out the incredible number of 1,097 patents in his 84 years of life, and still he could envision with youthful fervor.
When I look around at the resources of the electrical field today,
I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I
can only urge
endless
successors,
I'd reckless, giving money tested, get arrested, guessing, giving money tested, get arrested, get the message, and what I do, stupid, me, on TV talking like it's just you and me, on TV talking like it's just you and me, I'm just saying how I feel, man. I'm on TV talking like it's just you and me. I'm a people suing me. I'm on TV talking like people suing me. I'm on TV talking drama, people suing me. I'm on TV drama, people suing me. I'm on TV.
Edison thought he was the best invented brain around.
He was self-taught,
very competitive, maniacally focused.
But he was a colorful character.
Down to earth.
He had a sense of humor.
Edison single-handedly created the image of an inventor.
Edison, tonight on American...
Drama, people suing me, I'm on TV. Drama, people... Drama, people suing me, I'm on TV. Drama, people suing me, I'm on TV.
Exclusive corporate funding for American Experience is provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance. American Experience is also made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
October 1922, a film crew arrived in the small town of West Orange, New Jersey, to spend some time with one of the most famous men in the world, the phenomenally prolific American inventor, Thomas Edison. Over the course of a few days, the cameras captured the great man at work, chatting with employees and conducting experiments in his lab, overseeing tests of packing materials in his factories, and catching up on the latest advances in the device for which he was best known.
The things that Edison invented are so omnipresent in our society. They've touched the lives of millions and millions of people and totally changed them. We live in a world that Edison invented.
Incandescent light, sound recording, motion pictures. For these and scores of other inventions, Edison had justly earned acclaim as the inventor of the age.
This is a replica of the first lamp.
But no mere machine could account for his metamorphosis from inventor to icon.
It's 8 o'clock.
We think we are moving very, very fast today. Let me tell you, all those folks in Manhattan, as Thomas Edison is walking the streets, thought their bodies couldn't stand the shock of how fast they were moving.
Poised at the starting line of America's rush into the modern world, Edison became its standard bearer.
Hello.
The impact of his native genius made infinitely more powerful by his timing, his canny knack for self-promotion, and his compulsive need to win.
Edison was very competitive. The more people who tried to find the answer, the more tempting it was for him to take it on. He was maniacally focused on maintaining control.
In the end, the intensity of Edison's drive proved both blessing and curse, costing him the allegiance of a lifelong friend and control of the industry to which he'd given life, even as it guaranteed him a kind of immortality.
There were other great inventors. Then there was Edison. He understood that inventing is not just having an idea. And so he made Edison a name to be reckoned with.
In the late winter of 1876, the scattered residents of Menlo Park, New Jersey, eyed a curious new building just up the hill from the train station. It could easily have been mistaken for a school or a Quaker meeting house. In fact, it was a laboratory, a 5,000 square foot facility entirely dedicated to nurturing the ideas of one man, an up-and-coming entrepreneur by the name of Thomas Alva Edison. No private laboratory in the country was so well equipped. From the apothecary jars filled with all manner of chemicals and organic materials, to the scientific instruments and shop tools, Edison had everything he could possibly need to make the natural world bend to his will.
He had this keen sense that he needed different kinds of resources in order to invent. And so Menlo Park becomes a kind of blank slate on which to come up with this idea of invention that's uniquely his.
Most successful inventors throughout history were largely people trying to accomplish a task. They had a day job, effectively, and invention was a way of furthering that. Edison decided that invention was his day job.
At 29, Edison had the audacious ambition of a man who'd come from nothing and who had everything to prove. His was a classic American story, a spectacular rise from humble beginnings that soon would be told and retold and told again. Born in 1847 and raised in Port Huron, Michigan, near the edge of a small country then on the verge of becoming great, Thomas Edison was all pluck and initiative from the start. By his own account, he was curious to the point of mischief. He once spent hours sitting on a neighbor's goose eggs in an effort to hatch them, and set fire to a barn just to see what it would do. Given just 3 months of formal schooling, he spent the carefree afternoons of boyhood reading his way through the library and obsessively conducting chemistry experiments in the cellar. Money was tight, so to finance his dabbling, he went to work at the age of 12, taking a job as a newsboy on the train that ran daily between Port Huron and Detroit. Along the way, in stations up and down the line, he became fascinated with the telegraph, which was beginning to knit the growing nation together as the rails were, only with lengths of copper wire.
Is there a more leading-edge thing going on in his world than telegraphy, moving real information at the speed of light with very sophisticated technologies to make it happen? He was amazed by it. He was that kind of kid.
Edison's fascination sparked a quest for mastery. He taught himself Morse code and practiced sending and receiving telegraph messages for up to 18 hours a day, before finally landing his first job as an operator in 1862, when he was just 15. By then, he'd become aware that he was losing his hearing, the racket of the world growing increasingly dim. But with telegraphy, he found that deafness gave him an edge. When in a telegraph office, he later recalled, I could hear only the instrument directly on the table at which I sat. And unlike the other operators, I was not bothered by other instruments.
This condition made him feel like he could think more and he could concentrate more. He became very introspective. He often felt like he was alone even when there were other people around.
For 5 years, Edison worked as a press operator, deciphering the dots and dashes of the news reports as they came in over the wires. But the task, once mastered, ceased to inspire him. Given his druthers, he took the night shift, which gave him plenty of free time to read and experiment. Before long, he was tinkering with the telegraphic equipment.
Edison didn't have a lot of formal schooling. Most of his technical education came from the practice of telegraphy. The telegraph offices were schools of electricity. The nature of electricity itself was something he studied and learned how to think about how that system operated, how he might improve it. Edison slowly began to think of himself as an inventor.
Edison starts at the core, the mother lode of the technological transformation in America. That's very, very important to the way that his mind and his confidence and his place at that machine kind of come together to launch the rest of his journey.
In early 1869, Edison resigned his post as a telegraph operator, and at the age of 22, moved to New York, with a few borrowed dollars in the pocket of his threadbare suit to pursue his career as an inventor. He spent the next several years bouncing from one short-lived partnership to another, mainly developing and manufacturing small lots of telegraphic devices on contract. Sleep, Edison later recalled, was a scarce article in those days. But he was meticulous and tenacious, and no technical challenge could cow him. Charged with perfecting others' crude machines, his agile mind spun out a seemingly infinite array of variations. Automatic telegraphs and printing telegraphs, and so-called multiplex telegraphs, which were capable of sending more than one message at the same time on the same wire. The booming industry rewarded him with confidence and also with cash. As one associate put it, if you should tell me you could make babies by machinery, I shouldn't doubt it. By the mid-1870s, Edison had a growing stack of successful telegraphic patents to his name and enough capital to finance his dream laboratory in Menlo Park.
Edison took a real risk in going to Menlo Park. He had to be pretty bold to build this new thing, invention laboratory, and you were going to become a professional inventor who was constantly cranking out new technology. But it was because he had this vision of how to become a great inventor.
This was astoundingly revolutionary. You know, I want to invent. I'm going to be about invention, right? I don't really want to be bothered lots of times with very much else.
It was May of 1876, and Edison was anxious to get down to work. His staff was already in place, a small group of experimental assistants and skilled machinists, many of whom he had worked with for years. All that remained was to move in his family, his wife Mary, whom he'd met in the spring of 1871 and married several months later, and their children, Marion and Thomas Alva Jr., or as their Morse-loving father had dubbed them, Dot and Dash. Edison installed them in a spacious house just down the hill from the laboratory, and that, excepting Sundays, was more or less the last they would see of him. From the very beginning, Menlo Park thrummed like a hive. In the long open rooms of the laboratory, as many as a dozen men were at work at once, conducting experiments, cutting patterns, banging together crude machines.
Edison loved the chase. He wanted to break open very interesting and challenging problems with a lot of promise in them.
The drive had something to do with technical inquiry, a kind of ambition to know or to figure out things that nobody had thought of yet. It wasn't just like answering questions that everybody knew were there and didn't have answers yet. It was like even coming up with the questions and answering them.
Though telegraphic equipment was still his primary focus, the plan at Menlo Park, as Edison put it to a friend, was to bring out a minor invention every 10 days and a big thing every month or so.
Nobody had the kind of resources that Edison had. He could say, you work on this kind of carbon, and you work on this kind of carbon, and you work on this kind of carbon.